Very good.
Again, we're running slightly ahead of time.
Yes, so plenty. I will be a bit of the odd medievalist in this context, but I will start from a posthumanist point of view. So in her Cyborg Manifesto, probably familiar to many of you, Donna Haraway states that the contemporary world, being formed of the implosion of technical, mythic, organic, political, economic, oneric, and textual, it produces cyborg bodies. In Haraway's terminology, a cyborg is a hybrid comprising organic and technology, an entity crossing human, animal, and machine. These cyborg bodies destabilize human organic temporality in favor of a new temporality and an alternative structure of lineage. As Pramod Nayar points out, Haraway's cyborg hybrid body disturbs the human categories of identity like ethnicity and gender, and even the dichotomy between living and non-living. The cross-species cyborg is also characterized by a deeply ironic and yet utopic nature. The cyborg, and I quote, the cyborg is resolutely committed to partiality, irony, intimacy, and perversity. It is oppositional, utopian, and completely without innocence. That's Haraway's quote. For this reason, as Amalina Damley highlights, the cyborg represents an alternative to traditional dominant discourses and also an alternative to the appropriation of nature as a source to produce culture. Of course, Haraway states very clearly that the cyborg is a contemporary product, a post-Second World War hybrid, and that we, as products of our age, are ourselves all hybrids of technology and organic. Nonetheless, Haraway's definition talks to me not only as a 21st century critter, but also as a medievalist. Medieval culture also has a love-hate relationship with hybrids. Illumination in manuscript margins, for instance, show a profusion of fantastic hybrid figures whose fluid bodies join human, animal, vegetable, and artificial. Despite the preoccupation of medieval theology with drawing a clear-cut divide between human and non-human, or maybe because of the hybrid's problematic stance, scientific and literary texts portray and discuss hybrid body. And the hybrid most commonly represented in medieval culture are human-animal or animal-animal hybrids. Yeah. And this is actually, human-animal hybrids is actually the topic of my present project. However, today I will rather deal with what we might indeed call technobodies, a less common typology of hybrids. So humanoid and animal forms with artificial objects as appendages. I will use two cases drawn from the 14th century Roman Pes Fori. The sea knights, sort of fish-like hybrids that incorporate weapons and an armor on their body. This is not an accurate... I don't know what you're doing. Okay. Sorry about that. Don't spoil the fun. Okay. Well, that went awry. So obviously this is not a representation of the sea knights in Pes Fori, but the sea knight as an iconographical motive was quite common. I just wanted to make this clear beforehand. So the sea knights and Pastillon, a human baby who is born with a crossbow of nerve and flesh attached to his body. These human-animal object hybrids, I would argue, constitute a sort of pre-modern posthuman machine. That was it. A pre-modern posthuman machine in the sense that they challenge categories and subsume human-animal and mechanical functions in an undefined, fluid, ever-changing body. To do so, I will focus only on the aspects of these characters' hybridizations that interweave animal and mechanical. And I will do so by reflecting on Haraway's cyborg. Not differently from the cyber, the techno-hybrids I will discuss represent too a different way to appropriate nature, and are as well non-innocent and ironic in the way in which they reuse aristocratic values and rethink society and life. But even beyond that, these human-animal object machines have the potential, I hope, to give us a useful vantage point on the way pre-modern cultures too use techno-hybrids, techno-bodies, as places of negotiation between personal identity, natural order, and cultural structures. So, let's go to Pastore, the first case drawn from this romance. Pastore is a French prose romance composed in the 14th century in French at the Hainaut court, so present-day Belgium. And it was a bestseller, although we only have 10 manuscripts, but we know that it was quite widespread. And 10 manuscripts is not that a little number for a medieval romance, considering especially that it was huge. It's probably the largest piece of literature from pre-modern time, definitely. And the plot is humongous, and it sort of portrays the a shivery, dazzling prehistory of the British Islands, starring Alexander the Great and King Arthur together, for instance. And the plot is humongous, the number of characters outstanding, so as the episode. In one of the episodes, in the third part of the romance, the knight Betide, who travels incognito as the White Knight, is brought by a shapeshifter magician on a faraway island that seems deserted. But in fact, one Saturday, the beach gets populated with strange creatures. He saw coming towards him four fish as big as hunting dogs, each of which was 2 feet tall. But they had a very sturdy and big chest, and the head above it was shaped as a hen. And on top of their head, each had a long spike, the length of one arm and a half, in the manner of a sword. And on their back, they had something of a shield from the head to the tail, and this was shaped as a fish tail. These are the poisson chevalier. These creatures are described as two-legged fish who integrate in their bodies organic appendages, typical of fish, the tail, with organic appendages in the shape and in the function of human artifacts. But they are, in fact, organic. They're sort of made of bone and skin, although the text is not really clear about it. Since the beginning, therefore, this fish represents a literally an embodiment of a social and human character, the knight, Poisson Chevalier. Betide, the protagonist in this episode, notices very quickly that these fish knights are also quite professional and courteous in their manner of fighting. No. Yeah, that's going very well. Fish knights are also quite professional and courteous in their manner of fighting. They attack him one at a time, they emerge from the sea, range as an army during battle, they make expeditions to retrieve the bodies of their dead. Betide finds this behavior revealing of their franchise, chivalry quality, and some intelligence, reason, again, this topic of intelligence. But that does not refrain him from making the best out of the situation. And since he's hungry, and they're in fact nothing but fish, he eats them. That's bad timing. The war continues. Betide resists for days to the numerous waves of fish knights until one day, the king of these creatures, he himself characterized by a flesh and bone crown on top of his head, goes up to him and, with cries and gestures, proposes to settle things in a duel. When Betide wins the duel, obviously, the king respects the outcome and even offers to the human knight one of his fish knights as food. And when the king was on the land, he went to the white knight and bowed to him and had one of his fish knights beheaded. And then he went closer to the knight and made signs that he should eat it, but the noble knight refused. So clearly, the feast sounds now somehow ghastly, and he refuses. What has changed Betide's attitude is a feeling of continuity with the fish knights. Even though Betide's shield and armor are of steel instead of skin and bone, The humanoids and the fishnoids are both techno-hybrids. That's probably through the episode this awareness starts to arise. This continuity, however, skips the human and its defining traits, like language. The communication between Betty Day and the Fish King is ensured by a system of animal cries with chivalric meanings. But the most significant moment arrives later when the Fish Knights involve Betty Day in an infinite series of tournaments. And the Sea Knights liked jousting with him more than with anybody else, and they thought fair that none of them should be considered valiant if he had not jousted against him. The tournament was spectacular and incredible to watch, and the bold knight jousted with great pleasure. However, this chivalry idyll is exhausting. On the first occasion, Betty Day has himself rescued by a ship that's passing by. When the sailors ask him if the island was inhabited, he answers, "I did not see man or woman." The tournament, the chivalric ritual per excellence, erases space's difference. As Peggy McCracken and Carl Steele have pointed out, in this episode, culture underlies nature and triumphs. In fact, according to Sylvia Hewitt, Passeforet naturalizes chivalry ideology in many ways. Nature is a space to be colonized, but feudal chivalry culture is already present in nature. I would also argue that the Fish Knights demonstrate the inhumanity inherent in following obsessively chivalric rules. The fish, more knightly than the knight himself, trigger a dark irony on chivalry and its codes. The concept of human is overcome by the trans-specific animal knight machine. Moreover, the description of the armed fish overturns the imagination of the time in which the fighting gear was inseparable from the morphology of the human body. For instance, this is an illustration that is not an illustration of these fish parts, but it was quite common. And as you can see, the first part is really just human body, and only the second part is a fish tail. It's more like in the shape of a mermaid. But this is not what Passeforet says. And we do not really find visual descriptions of what Passeforet describes. It's uncommon. On the contrary, these fish knights join directly sea monster and knight. The human is nothing but a bridge, joining animal and technical. This function as middle ground between animal and cultural function entails a disintegration of the human body and its biological identity. So let's leave the fish and go into a much more apparently human configuration of the techno-hybrid. In the fourth part of Passeforet, Priam, a noble lady, and a queen, gives birth to the first son of the king, Estonet. During labor, she has a vision. Her husband, Estonet, is betrayed and killed by a despicable knight called Troyan. She wakes up suddenly, screaming for labor pains and for her husband's death, and focuses all of her energy in shouting the mantra, "Kill the murderer and evil Troyan who killed my husband," over and over again. This very emotional circumstance triggers the extraordinary. The baby in her womb, overwhelmed with fury, comes into the world by ripping open the right side of his mother, who instantly dies, and the midwife takes the baby, gets rid of the placenta that enshrouds him, and looks at him astonished. And she found it fierce. And she found him fierce and extraordinary, as everyone there saw, because he kept in his right hand a crossbow so well crafted and made of flesh and nerves, and in his left hand a foot-long arrow so well crafted that there was nothing to change in it. As for the fish knights, the weapon is not made of wood or metal, but of organic material, and this part of Pasalian's body. Nonetheless, like the shield of the fish knights, the crossbow and the arrow are detachable. The midwife whispers into the baby ear to avenge his father and forcefully pries the weapons out of his hands. However, even if separated from the body, the techno-hybridism inherent at his birth continues to play an important role in Pasalion's life. It crystallizes his destiny and his genealogical function, avenging his father. He grows up surprisingly quickly, When 3 years old, he is fiercer and more eloquent than everyone. He insists to be nominated knight, even if he's just 3 years old, and once recovered his own organic cross, bow and arrow, extremely hard in spite of being made of flesh and nerve, he confronts Brouillon and kills him by piercing him with that precise arrow with one shot. The technohybridis is therefore a catalyzer of Passillon's monofunctional identity. But again, Passillon, the bloodthirsty knight, is also a three-year-old child who shakes his arms and feet for the joy of massacre, gets breastfed before battle, has a tantrum because he does not want to take off his armor before going to bed. The convergence in the same body of the caritas of his deathly mission and the childlike gesture partakes of a sinister humor and triggers an alarmed smile in the characters as well as maybe in the audience. The concern is also triggered by another aspect of Passillon's identity, quite visible precisely in the revenge scene. When Passillon saw the body on the ground, he jumped off his horse, kindled with anger, and went straight for the part of his body where the heart was, then with his teeth and hands, tore it apart, just like greyhounds eat the heart of their prey after it has been caught. The animal predatorial ferocity is indeed, since the baby's first breath, the other defining feature of this character. He gets his name because he exceeds the lion in fierceness and courage. Passion. He exceeds the lion in courage. His act of ripping apart Brouillon's heart and with his teeth is explicitly associated with the behavior of a hunting animal. And it's really not common for an aristocrat, I would say. The animality of Passillon is certainly a reflection of the fact that medieval culture tended to bestow upon children the status and behavior of an animal, children being a sort of mid-ground between animal and human, as small children at least. But it also responds to the same expressive need of the fishnoids. Passillon's mechanical hybridity fixates the human into a pure function, a pure passage. By doing so, it erases the human and allows the animal to fill in. Before conclusion, I would like to offer a key to read these two technohybrids by comparing them with the medieval robots or automata. The automata appear in certain romances and chansons de geste since the 12th century, although there was not much knowledge of how these things worked. They mostly arrived in the West through Middle East as gifts, so it was really not. Up until the 15th century, the only automata that were known were those fake knights that ring the bells in the big clocks and so it was really not an actual. I mean, there was never an actual experience of these automata, but they were indeed part of the imagination of Romans, and they are in a way like hybrids, in the sense that they are automatic mechanisms. This is, for instance, one that is designed by Leonardo da Vinci, so way after the Middle Ages, not way after, a little bit after the Middle Ages. So they are like hybrids in the sense that they are automatic mechanisms with a humanoid or animal-like shape in the Romans, in the literature. They are a reverse mirror image of the examples I have examined so far, insofar as nothing of them is biological, but rather the artificial and inorganic materials imitate the human and the flesh in their shape and function. Moreover, the automata performs one specific function of the organic, excluding all possible other ones. This aspect, however, is in common with the fish knight and the crossbow boy. The technohybridism too nails the character to a function. Moreover, like Emmanuel Baumgartner suggests, the automata defies the time continuum by blocking time in an eternal cycle. It seems to me that the techno-hybridism also pulls the character out of time and injects him into a non-human temporal frame. Passillon, who becomes adult in 3 years, the Fish Knights who are stuck in a perpetual series of tournaments. Nonetheless, the comparison with automata highlights the specificities of the techno-hybrids. The automaton is often a demonic or devilish creature. The cyclic repetition of its movements is in stark contrast with the linear advancement of time of chivalric adventures. The human knights fight robots in literature because they want to oppose to the mechanization of life these robots represent. The techno-hybrids, on the other way, create an alternative to the same mechanization. They counterpoint it by making organic the machines and artifacts that are familiar to the aristocratic life. They idealize a fluid relationship between nature and culture, in which the modification of bodies and spaces falls within a reassuring global framework coherent with feudal ideology. This reflection compels me to sketch a few provisional conclusions. The techno-hybrid in this late medieval romance visualizes a negotiation between three terms, the human, the animal, and the technical. And in fact, the very idea of an aggressive technology organically integrated within the body is exactly what distinguishes the animals endowed with fangs, claws, and horns to defend themselves or attack from humans, who instead, in the words of medieval encyclopedias, are the only species born naked and completely defenseless. This two-way hybridization seems perfectly coherent with the knight's nature as deeply displaced outside the human towards the non-human. The close relationship of the knight with his animals, real, like the sea, the hunting dogs and birds, and symbolic as well, like the ones embroidered on his clothes or forged on his shield, make him, the knight, a hybrid, or, in the words of Geoffrey Jerome Cohen, a complex assemblage capable of linking human, object, and animals. In this perspective, the techno-hybrid embodies the crossing of two identity-building processes, one directed towards an animal body, one towards an idealized cultural persona, fixed into a function that perpetuates itself, always identical. By intersecting these two axes, the techno-hybrid provides a particularly fitting image for the naturalization of chivalric feudal culture, its rituals, and its code of honor. However, the ironic component of the techno-hybrid challenges this message. In the case of the Fish Knights, where we would expect a story of colonization of nature, we bump instead into a story in which it is the animal, in their animal machine configuration, who are more cultured than the human. Up to a check, the sterile respect of chivalric rules, the isolation, the flattening of communication to a mere transmission of war and tournament messages, overrides the human. Tassignon's hybridization is less radical, but it yields too to a dehumanization. The compulsion to pursue a clan vendetta modifies his body in order to transform the human into its function of avenger. But this is made at the cost of his mother's life, made into pieces by the unnatural birth of a little alien, and at the cost of the baby natural development and childhood. These observations are but a starting point of a broader reflection that would deserve further investigations. Many questions are left open. The relationship of the hybrid with time, with nature, with landscape and its modification. Nonetheless, I hope to have stimulated your curiosity and provided an eccentric, pre-modern, amusing contribution to this conference's large discussion on animal machines and machine animals. Thank you.